Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating, telling people about the podcast. We really appreciate it. We're coming to the end of a year and it's been quite a doozy. Some fascinating science and some amazing stories. We're going to be finishing with a bang, the Big Bang specifically. We're going to be speaking to Professor of Astronomy at the University of Virginia, Kelsey Johnston, who's written a book about some of the biggest questions there are. And I think it's a lovely piece where we're going to ask two big questions. How do we know that the universe began when it began? And where does the universe end? If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us. We're at @NewsTalkScience. We start, as we've started every show this year, looking back at some of the more interesting stories from this week. We're joined by Dr. Annie Curtis from the Royal College of Surgeons Ireland in Dublin and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Annie, our first story has to do with sort of archaeology, but sort of archaeology of the future.
It's like archaeology in space.
Yeah.
You know, we think of pigs in space, but this is archaeology in space. Like, so we're very, you know, familiar with trying to preserve our heritage on Earth, you know, things like the Vikings and all of that. But this is about space heritage. And I suppose I was thinking as I was reading this article, it's a really topical area right now. And we have such inspirational figures in Ireland, like Nora Patton, in terms for space exploration. And, you know, just like Iron Age huts and Viking settlements, what they're talking about is preserving sort of these sites on Mars and in other places, which should really be kind of archaeological sites and not to be disrupted or disturbed.
But what do you mean archaeological sites on Mars?
So as in like, say where, you know, Rover. Is that right?
Yeah, the Curiosity rover. Yeah, there's lots of rovers.
Lots of rovers. And, you know, any of the debris and bits and bobs that like fell, all of those things, should they be just considered trash or should they actually be kind of considered a map of where we have been? And there was a lovely thing is like in the article when they talk about just as our species once left Africa, like we are currently in the process of leaving Earth. And there should be some sort of archaeological record of that, and should we preserve that? And we're not even just talking about Mars, like we're also
going to build a space museum that no one can visit.
No, these places. So, like, just the way, you know, what was the place, the Viking settlement over by the Liffey? What was that called again?
Oh, Dublinia.
Yeah, Dublinia, and you know, just the way we preserve those areas, we should actually preserve these areas.
Woodkey.
Yeah. We should actually preserve these areas in space. And, like, even in terms of like the sites such as Apollo 11's Tranquility Base, where, you know, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took their first steps in the moon. You know, we should even grant these places almost heritage status. That's what they're talking about.
Right.
And what I didn't realise is that humans first reached Mars in 1971. Did anyone know that? That was the first, yeah, I didn't realise it was that long ago.
What was the name of the mission? Can you remember it? Do you know that they sent back photos of Mars that showed it to be redder than it was? And it was just a filter issue in the photographs.
Ashed up.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Not with their iPhone, though.
No.
No, what was the mission called, Mars?
I can't remember.
Yeah,
no.
Viking, that's right. Viking, yeah. And that, it all comes together.
Oh,
Viking.
Woodkey. Yeah.
So the idea is that we shouldn't go back and visit these, or that do we need to do something?
We just need to preserve them. You know,
do we need to do anything to preserve them?
Well, we do probably because, you know.
Not go there, I suppose,
not
is the first
there,
bit.
Yeah. Yeah, because I suppose the thing about it is that, you know, these sites will actually kind of outlast humanity as well. So it's just to ensure that they're still there.
Right. So essentially install, like send a mission up there, which is velvet ropes and like these things all around and just say €5 entry. Or like one of those donation boxes no one ever gives anything to museums.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah, Jonathan. Yeah.
Oh, I do. I just assume nobody else does.
Really?
Oh,
really?
I do. Big time.
You know,
I'm tapping three
the fake
times.
Fake hand drop. You
know? I have like a tenner on a little piece of vinyl string. All right. Interesting idea. Like, who's suggesting this and what is the...
Well, it was actually a paper that was published in Nature Astronomy. Didn't even think Nature had a journal called Astronomy. I'm looking over Shane for this. And it was called The Emerging Archaeological Record of Mars.
Yeah. All right. Shane, our second story has to do with another space venture, and it is a European rival to Starlink. What is this?
Yeah, so Starlink is the satellite company that's owned by Elon Musk, and it offers, I think one of the major uses of it is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So the Ukrainian military are able to use the Starlink system in order to communicate effectively with one another. But this is...
It provides internet connection across the world, no matter where you are.
Yeah, and there are 7,000 small satellites that make up the network, which is huge. And the European Union now realizes that we can't rely on private interests to provide these essential services, right? Because anyone can take over them, anyone could switch them off. So they are launching a new range of satellites called Iris Squared. And it's effectively going to ensure, they say, EU cybersecurity. So it will help us with things like television, internet, weather forecasting and basic defence systems. It's not the first pan-European satellite network. Of course, we have Galileo, which we all use for our GPS systems. We also have Copernicus that people might be familiar with. It observes the Earth and gives us an awful lot of data for weather. This is expected to be operational in 2030, which sounds soon, but from when you think about a security point of view, it's actually quite a long way away. And as I said, it'll rely on a network of satellites. There'll be 290 of them in total. And even how they speak to one another and how they speak then to the users on the ground is itself very interesting, how they're able to maintain this sort of low Earth or medium Earth orbit. They have to use a series of thrusters to basically get to where they need to be.
This network of satellites is kind of interesting because when Musk announced that he was going to do Starlink, I remember before any of them had launched, it seemed absolutely ludicrous, like a total pie in the sky idea. You're going to launch 7,000 satellites. Don't be ridiculous.
And more on the way.
But he has done it. Yeah. And at the time, NASA and I think European Space Agency said, you can't do that. You really shouldn't do that. And now they're like, oh, we better do the same.
Well, there is a lot to be said for not polluting the low Earth orbit with just tons of small satellites because they do get in the way of other things. And so
like watching,
it's like space junk almost. So, you know, and they can cause damage then to the more serious satellites that are needed for other things.
It's like congestion.
Yeah. Exactly. But I do want to kind of, you know, ask Jonathan, maybe you can't ask you on radio, but many years ago, you and I went head to head on the merits of Elon Musk and his role.
I think I flipped. I think he's absolutely gone off the edge and some of the things he says and his allegiance has absolutely gone mental now. But you still have to say, one way or another, revolutionize electric vehicles, revolutionize space travel. You know, he's certainly a man in history, but is he someone who I think is?
I just want to say I was
humanity?
Right, absolutely. Jonathan. That's
you called him. You did call him. Right.
You kind of looked to help.
But wait, he may make America super efficient. So
this is true.
We'll see. He may come good again.
Oh wow!
Our third story, Annie, has got nothing to do with space. It has to do with boners.
Thank you, Jonathan. I didn't think we were going to go there so quickly.
Things are looking up.
So this is a story about Viagra,
yes.
Right? And Viagra, I have to say, well, okay, first of all, what is Viagra? Viagra is a drug that treats individuals with erectile dysfunction. And what I
do, and how does it do that, Annie?
So, Jonathan, how it does it is it inhibits this enzyme called PDE5, right? And if you have lots of PDE5, you don't have a lot of nitric oxide and you have kind of vessels that close. So if you have a drug that inhibits PDE5, it keeps lots of NO, nitric oxide, in your blood vessels and that dilates your blood vessels. Okay, so that's how it works.
And blood vessels dilated is what gives you firm flesh.
Firm flesh.
In the nether regions.
And yes, absolutely. Right?
You're the doctor. Come on.
Well,
you should be totally fine talking about
doctor.
This.
I know exactly what you're talking about, Jonathan. I just don't know how far I can go on radio. Right. So, and how Viagra was discovered is just the classic story. I don't know if people know this. But so Pfizer were looking at this drug for cardiovascular disease, for angina. And they were looking at it in the 1990s and it was really doing nothing, right? Absolutely nothing. And they were about to actually can the program. And they said, you know what? We'll take 8 males, and they were the study was down in South Wales. We're going to take 8 males and we're going to give them the highest dose possible to see if there's any effects. And these were healthy males, and back then phase 1 studies always done in males, right? Not the case anymore, thankfully. And so they did the study, and in terms of their cardiovascular effects, nothing. But a nurse noticed something, right, was happening in the nether regions. And the individuals also pronounced that they were having this unusual side effect, yeah, which was they were having an erection. And then they did a number of other studies after that. And normally with studies, you can't, it's actually hard to get people to take the pills. But in these early Viagra studies, the men would not give the pills back. Right, so
that's always a good sign if you're trying to sell something.
They were onto something. But talking about pills, so we know Viagra is this blue pill; it's like classic now. But the new innovation that is coming out is basically Viagra as like a wafer thin sort of. It's like a wafer thin, right?
Yeah.
And the advantage of that is you don't need water to take it, because some people actually do have some issues with taking tablets. And it's much more discreet. Instead of carrying around a box of pills, you're carrying around a couple of leaflets sort of things that you can just put into your mouth as you need it.
It does. I mean, like, I don't know. Like, is it really that necessary to replace the pill?
Well, I think, you know, there was a professor of andrology, which study of male reproductive system and urological issues. And he said, box of pills in your pocket or a discreet film in your wallet, I know which one I would like to take.
The phrase marketing gimmick comes
to mind. Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to talk about Viagra and use lots of euphemisms for erections for 5 minutes to provide a bit of levity, because this show is going to get quite dark in about 15 minutes, is my guess, as we talk about animals and death. But before we do that, Shane, let's finish off with our final story, which is kind of a positive look towards the future, because we're looking at so much research and these amazing tools that can accelerate our ability to understand the world around us. Talk to me about some of the more interesting stories to come next year.
Yeah, it's amazing that we can actually predict with some confidence some of the science stories that we probably will be talking about on the show next year. Now, most of them will be completely blue sky stuff that we just wouldn't have seen coming. But there are certain things we know are going to come. And I'll give you a flavour of them from Nature, one of the leading journals. One is about more weight loss drugs. These have revolutionised that area, and there are more on the way. There are some that are in phase 3 trials at the moment. One from Eli Lilly that in its phase 2 trial showed a 24% weight loss over 11 months. I think the sociological and psychological issues of these weight loss drugs are probably going to be expanded on more in the coming years. And we'll also see perhaps news around use of existing weight loss drugs for diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So that's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
There is great excitement about space exploration in 2025. 2024 saw the first private spacecraft land on the moon. 2025 looks like we're going to have a lot more private-led activity on the moon, including a mission that's going to take a NASA-built drill to the moon with a mass spectrometer in the drill. It's going to dig down into the lunar crust and tell us a little bit about what's within. But I think the big scientific issue for 2025 is the return of President Trump and what that's going to mean. We're going to have a climate skeptic, a vaccine skeptic president, and we're also going to have Elon Musk very close to the president, and we're possibly going to have the repeal of things like the safe development of AI executive order and perhaps the removal of the US and the Paris Climate Agreement. It's a very interesting time to be a scientist. And I think we will perhaps have one of the more sort of scientifically impactful presidencies that we've ever had in the coming 4 years. And that's all going to kick off in January 2025. Watch this space.
Exciting, exciting times. Dr. Shane Berger from UCD, from RCSI. Dr. Annie Curtis, thank you very much. You might find yourself every once in a while asking yourself what it's all about. Is this all that there is? Why is there something rather than nothing? On the face of it, these are not very scientific questions, but it is pivotal that we ask them if we are to progress our understanding of the world. That's according to our next guest, Kelsey Johnson. She's a professor of astronomy at the University of Virginia and author of Into the Unknown, The Quest to Understand the Mysteries of the Cosmos. She joins me now. Kelsey, it's great to have you on. This is the season where we talk about, you know, looking to the stars for guidance. That is the weakest link I can make of this item to Christmas season. So just run with it. Your book kind of talks about quite a lot, but I wanted to really focus on two big questions because they're huge questions. And it'll take us a long time to kind of pour through them. And the first question really is that one thing. And maybe you might sort of explain why it is that you wanted to write this book about these kind of big questions that we ask ourselves.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. Well, here's the thing. Here's my observation, and it's maybe a little bit grim, but I think this will resonate with many people. My observation is that we modern humans amid modern life are becoming increasingly disconnected from the universe. I don't know if the universe cares, but I think this is actually really bad for us as humans, and I think it has a profound effect on our worldviews. So for me, writing this book is based on this crazy idea that it would do humanity some good to better understand the universe that we're a part of. And my hope is that with this book, I can invite people into a space of real existential curiosity to connect or reconnect with some of these big, beautiful questions that I think sit at the core of humanity.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the questions that to me are the most interesting ones are the ones that really overlap between, you know, science and philosophy. And so I'm going to ask you these two questions, which are impossible to answer in this show, but I want to explore where we are from an astronomical point of view. The first is, why is there something? Why are we here? Why is there something rather than nothing? Because this goes to the question of the beginning of everything and our understanding of how the universe came to be. Because it seems when we rewind the tape that there was a beginning, which seems ludicrous. How is that possible? And how is there something rather than nothing?
Well, I'll say it's not just impossible to answer in this show. It's impossible to answer full on. So this question, why there is something instead of nothing, takes us straight to the boundary of science, philosophy, and theology. And it may be unanswerable now, and it may be unanswerable forever. But if we don't think about it, it will be unanswerable because we're not trying to answer it. And it brings us to a really big philosophical knot. So there are a number of hypotheses on the table for where the universe could have come from. Some of them are supernatural. Some of them sound like science fiction. Some of them are more rooted in, I would say, conventional physics. But what if I could tell you, for this interview, for the sake of argument, I could tell you where the universe came from, and I could say it was a super intelligent extraterrestrial race, and they did an experiment, and here we are. Well, I would bet, Jonathan, your next question might be, well, where did they come from?
Yeah.
Right? So we end up in this infinite regression, and it's not clear philosophically how we get out of it. I know a number of people will argue and have certainly argued with me that we just have something, and that is the way things are, and that is the way things have always been.
It's very unsatisfying.
It is very unsatisfying, right? Because it then begs a whole number of other questions, like why this something and not some other something? And, you know, I just find myself not satisfied with that answer. I can't say that it's wrong, but I also don't like it. And I'm not happy to stop with that and stop answering, stop asking the question.
Okay, so let us just allow physics to take us as far as we can go. Because this point of the beginning of everything, this infinitesimally small point out of which everything came, how do we know that? And how do we know there wasn't something before that? Or another question falls out of that. Is it possible to ever know once you go through the tiniest point of the hourglass? Is anything before the Big Bang completely impossible for us to understand? Or what can physics tell us?
Oh, we need to go have drinks.
I've already had two.
Okay, well, still morning for me here on the East Coast of the U.S. Science can take us fairly far. And a lot of our science, our scientific understanding can take us as far back as a time we call the Planck time. And this is so small, it's hard to wrap our heads around. It's 10 to the minus, the power of minus 43 seconds, roughly. Before that time, the laws of physics as we understand them actually break down, right? So we know that we don't know what could have happened before, at times before that. But the other part of this that is very much at play is that many of the hypotheses on the table suggest that time itself came into being with the universe. So time as a dimension came into being with the universe. And if that's true, then how do we ask what even happened before it? Because that question no longer makes sense. So not only do we have a physical issue that we need to figure out, we have a linguistic issue because we don't have the language to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, the kids these days use this term sigma all the time, right? But actually in the physics sense, sigma gives us a number to denote how confident we are that something happened. And I'm wondering where we sit with this idea of the beginning of the universe being the Big Bang and the idea that time just sort of popped into existence along with all the laws of physics at the beginning of the universe. Like, it's so absolutely ludicrous that this is our understanding of the world. What is our level of confidence? When we look at observations of our universe, when we think about, you know, the things that we know for sure and that we can piece together through the Standard Model and all these sort of things, when we put all of our knowledge together, what level of confidence have we in the fact that the universe was created out of the Big Bang, out of this tiny dot that before which was a horizon with which we cannot philosophically or physically pass?
So I think you will get different answers from different astrophysicists on this question. But here's my take, because you're talking to me. First thing I want to say is, when we talk about the Big Bang, I think that that term is often misused as the actual creation of the universe. But really what the Big Bang refers to, and this is where we have a lot of confidence, is this radical period of inflation,
right?
Very early times where the universe went from being some tiny, tiny little nugget of something to, you know, sizes greater than we can fathom. And that happened very fast. And we have a fair amount of confidence in that from a number of different pieces of evidence. What we don't have any confidence in, or at least what I have almost no confidence in, is what happened before that and where that even tiny nugget of a universe that there was to be inflated, where that came from to begin with. And so we're sort of going, you know, backwards down on infinite regression. But we have so much observational evidence that the universe did inflate, that it is expanding, that it has expanded. All of these different lines of evidence point to the same conclusion, but that doesn't get us back this horizon of our understanding of what happened before that.
Right. Okay. So that leaves us with this big question about the beginning of the universe. And it's something that I think we can't possibly ever know for the reasons we've kind of outlined. So let me leave the listener with that, although we have so much more to talk about, and understand that this is, you know, this is why these sort of books I find absolutely fascinating. If you have that period between Christmas and New Year to actually finally just rest, these are the sort of books that I love to read. I want to go to the other end, because this is something that we theoretically could know. And that is, where is the edge? And how do we know that's the edge? So we talk about the universe constantly expanding. Expanding into what? I mean, if the universe isn't there, how can it expand? And that it implies an edge to something, that there's a physical space after which there's something that isn't just the void of space. So can you explain that for me?
Yes. Well, maybe I can try to explain it. You know, this is one of the first questions that when I'm teaching about the expansion of the universe that my students will ask. And it makes sense to ask this question, right? This is a good, valuable question. And there are a couple different ways I can try to explain it. One, first, let me say, we don't know that the universe has an edge. We don't know that it has a boundary. All we know is what we can see. And we can only see, I should put this in air quotes, but we're in audio, so you can't see it. We can only see about 13.7 billion light years away, because that's as old as the universe is, and that's all the time we've had for light to get to us. Beyond that, we don't know, and we can't know, right? Because there's no way anything could have been communicated to us. But what is the universe expanding into? There are really kind of two ways I think about this. One is, and this is going to sound like science fiction, and maybe it is, but it is a hypothesis that's on the table. And
can I just say all science reaches science fiction at the edge? Like all science, it seems to me, reaches the realms of craziness. You go to quantum, you go, you know, the beginning of the universe, you go, you know, the limits of human ability, it all, everything, it all ends up in that era of, is that real? That sounds crazy. But please continue.
But that's how we make progress, right? And I feel like invoking Arthur C. Clarke here with some of the ways he thought about how we make progress. But, you know, it is possible, and there are actually some physical reasons to think this might be true, that our universe is part of a hyperdimensional landscape that exists beyond the dimensionalities that we perceive and we interact with. And so we don't rule that out. And that is on the table, that there is this hyperdimensional space called, we call it, because we're so good at naming things, we call it the bulk. And so it could be that we, our universe, as we perceive it, exists in this thing we call the bulk. Now, that's one way to think about it. The other way.
But wait, what is the bulk?
What is the bulk? It's think about it. If our universe were, I really love sea kelp. I imagine Ireland is surrounded by sea kelp, but I really love sea kelp. Imagine our universe is like a two-dimensional piece of sea kelp floating in the ocean. The bulk would be that ocean that's around it.
Right.
And so there could be other pieces of sea kelp in that ocean too, right? That is another possibility that is legitimately on the table. But there's another way to think about it that I think is a little more abstract. And so give yourself a little bit of grace in trying to understand that.
More abstract than imaginary sea kelp universes?
Oh, I've got more where that came from.
Hit me.
Okay, so think about you... We love balloons. I swear a balloon company really needs to sponsor us. Okay, so you have a balloon, just a standard party balloon. And on this balloon, you draw a grid, yeah, right, of just cross hatches.
Yeah.
You can imagine that as the latex of that balloon stretches, the coordinate grid is becoming bigger or smaller.
Yeah.
And we could think about in our universe, space expanding. It could be that space itself, in some sense, is just, you know, the latex sitting there, but the coordinate grid is changing. And so the coordinate grid itself is becoming bigger or smaller as the universe, you know, for example, contracts or expands. And this is in many ways what actually general relativity tells us when we think about how space and time behave. It has to do with their coordinate grids growing or shrinking. And so it's a much more abstract way to think about it, but it's a valid way to think about it. And if we think about it this way, and it's just a coordinate grid changing, then we don't need to be expanding into something. It's just the coordinate grid changing. Now, I will confess that I don't love that as the explanation, but I also think it's true that, as you know, we have to check our biases, right? And just because we don't like an idea, and there are lots of reasons we might not like an idea, is not a reason that it's wrong.
Hmm. I got to say, you know, Kelsey, I only asked two questions. You didn't answer either of them. I mean, as a guest, you know, that's okay, a 2 out of 10 performance, to be honest. you know, do you know, it is always fun to kind of tease out these things, but it needs to be like a 3-hour show, I think, with, you know, like red wine and a fire. And it, like, we should do a show, a live show where it's just like a 3-hour, let's actually just spend time talking about it. And then we'll give people vegetables that they can throw at us if we get to, you know, go too deep. This could be a show that could run for years. You know, Broadway is what I'm thinking, Kelsey. But if you're thinking about someone who does want to think beyond the 9-to-5 and their meager existence, this book is called Into the Unknown, The Quest to Understand the Mysteries of the Cosmos. And it is a great way to spend some time in the darkness of the bedroom. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor of Astronomy at University of Virginia, Kelsey Johnson.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jonathan.
Well, a nice way, I think, to finish off the year, because we are thinking about... the, you know, the beginnings and the ends. And what is December except the end of one year and the beginning of a new another? We hope you have a wonderful Christmas. We'll be back in the next podcast with some of our favorite stories from the last year. So if you haven't inhaled this year's podcast, there are three fantastic features you shouldn't miss in next week's podcast. So look out for that. But a huge and extraordinary thank you to Aidan McKelvey, our longstanding and wonderful producer of the program, without whom this program would have been crap. thank you so much for all of your hard work. And thanks to Hugo da Silva on sound. Thanks to everyone who's been working on the program. And thank you to this wonderful audience who listen to us every week. We really, really appreciate it. We hope you have a wonderful Christmas and we will see you in the new year. Stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.